So I'll start by making sure that the model which I discussed is always there, and I'll just be specific what I'm going to discuss. So the system which I would like to address is bosonic or spin system with XY symmetry only in the EV plane, if you speak to talk about spin systems. So I will be talking about quantum bosons in two dimensions. At zero temperature, at half Feeling factor. So if you want to think about spins, it's just XY, easy plane, anisotropy in the spin system. Otherwise, you can think about two-dimensional systems where lattice, spin one half. So what are possible phases which you might have for this system? One obvious phase, if bosons are not coupled strongly, you have a superfluid, and you can characterize superfluid by bosonic. This is half Feeling factor. It means you have twice as many lattice points as you have boson. So it's Feeling factor one half. So you may have a superfluid phase, which is a generic phase for bosons if they are not strongly coupled. And also you have a lot of different solid phases. So the best known is called the checkerboard, when you have an order in the density-density correlation function. So the checkerboard solid is this one. It's analogous to the Ising magnet for the spin one half system. So this is checkerboard solid. And there are other solids when you also have kind of density-density correlation function diverging, but you have to define densities not on lattice points, you have to define densities on bonds or plaquettes. So the other one is so-called valence bond solid or collinear dimer model, collinear dimer phase. And you say that bosons arrange themselves in the following way, that one boson is sitting on this bond, another boson is sitting on this bond, roughly. Because well, the picture I can draw is obviously in some Fock state. So that's roughly the picture. And if you define bosonic density on those bonds, you also have a correlation function which diverges in this case. But you have to define, I know, bosonic density on bond, bond I, bond J, and then this correlation function on a certain momentum, you have a divergent response. This is G2 state, which means you can translate this solid only by one lattice spacing, you get another ground state. Here you have four different ground states. You can arrange them in X direction, but you can shift by A, and you can do the same in Y direction. So it's four-fold degenerate ground state. You also have plaquette solid, I know how to call it. Sorry? Yeah.
In plane Switzerland, you can define as anti-symmetric or symmetric state on a bond. So what do you mean by the number of bosons in a bond?
Well, in this case, imagine, well, in spin language, this would be singlet. So I am talking that it's a symmetric state of a boson between the two lattice points. Okay. In a good approximation, say, well, in the limiting case of this phase, when quantum fluctuations are completely suppressed, you have a bosonic boson is sitting here on the singlet state, which means symmetric between the two sides, boson is sitting on the symmetric state here, and so on and so forth. In the plaquette solid, you have two bosons sharing one plaquette, and that's where they run. For example, in ring exchange models, you have a term when two bosons in the corners of the plaquette can change places. And then just bosons will arrange themselves to occupy those plaquettes. Again, well, you can define plaquette density, and you will get a divergent response in the corresponding correlation function. So, and there are other solids. You can just, well, keep imagining different possibilities for solids. I will be mostly discussing superfluid, checkerboard, and superfluid valence bond solid transition. So the question which we have in this case is whether superfluid solid transition, solid can be any of those in principle. So I'm looking at superfluid solid transition. Again, as a change of the ground state at zero temperature. And, well, this question can be formulated as, is it always first order or continuous if possible? Well, and I will discuss one particular scenario which says that, yes, the continuous transition, especially for the case superfluid valence bond solid, the continuous transition is possible, And this is the scenario which I will just describe, maybe shortly. It's the confined critical point scenario. And the next question then is, if this is possible and the confined critical point scenario is allowed, then what's the criticality of this one? And in the discussion of the last issue, I will come to the discussion of XY models in general.
Is the message you're going to give restricted to two dimensions?
So far, I would say yes. I would like to stay in two dimensions, because in one dimensions, it's special. Okay. The one-dimensional case is not as generic, and yes, you always obviously have continuous transitions from superfluid to the solid phase. In one dimension, there is no problem. One dimension is special.
How about three?
Probably three dimensions is same as two dimensions. Well, at least from my understanding as I have it now, it's just four dimensions is not that different from two dimensions. Unless you specify a particular scenario. Maybe in a particular scenario the dimension will matter. What would you do if you just try to write down the naive Ginzburg-Landau theory? That's how the discussion starts. So if I do naive Ginzburg-Landau theory, I would do it the following way. I'm not saying, well, that's everybody will do it this way, but well, that's how I would do it. Well, of course, you can specify the order parameters which characterize all of the solids and the superfluid. So I'll start enumerating them. So I have a superfluid order parameter, a complex number. I have a checkerboard order parameter. I will call it SZ. Just, well, simply from the analogy with the Ising antiferromagnet. Otherwise, just, well, you can use any other notation. So I will call it SZ. Then I have valence bond solid order parameter. In principle, it can be ordered in X or Y directions. So in general, I will say, okay, I'll pick here BX, BY. The reason will be clear later why I have two. Yeah, maybe I have Plaquette solid. And the next point is that I don't want to do a naive expansion in powers of those order parameters to write down the Ginzburg-Landau theory for the following reason. I know that one phase, which is not allowed at least in models with positive definite statistics of particle water lines, is quantity order phase. I'll probably try to give this general argument. So I'll say, well, how I would write down the Ginzburg-Landau theory. So I would...
Sorry, what did you just say? Did
you repeat that? Yeah, I'll try to say, well, when you start doing this, typically you say, do an extension in different order parameters, but I say, well, this is not enough because I have to put a hard constraint on those order parameters. And I'll just try to explain why I need it. I simply enumerated here all order parameters, and I say, well, just imagine that I have some vector order parameter, and those are just components of this multi-dimensional order parameter.
You made a statement about the quantum, there are no quantum order phases.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying just well, to argue. If I say, well, those are components of some big S, it's a multi-component order parameter. In many cases, you have all of them zero when you average, and only one of them survives. Say, S1 and S2 give you a superfluid order parameter. Or you have ordering in checkerboard channel. Then you have all components zero except a Z average, the correlation function, the point correlation function, divergence. So the checkerboard solid, then you have valence bond solid. Let's say, but you always, as my understanding is that for models, at least I can more or less convince myself that, well, if you have positive definite statistics of bosonic water lines, one of the orders has to be non-zero. You cannot have all of them zero at once.
No, but you can. I mean, when with models constructed that have ground states which are don't break any symmetries at all.
Yeah, I'll just try to discuss it. How it works. I say, well, I'm not doing the exact thing. I'm just saying,
I'm just saying we have counterexamples to your claim.
It has to, well, I'll say in which sense such models exist, and I'll just discuss them. They have to be critical points with algebraic order, otherwise, it's not possible.
There are counterexamples to that, too. I mean, there.
Do you have a positive definite statistics of particle water lines?
Yeah.
Well, okay, I'll just present the argument and you'll just try to tell me just what's different. So naively, I would put here just for a constraint. which means I have to have one of the orders which I have here. Now, what's the argument? There is a relation. Well, most of the time I will discuss this model in terms of particle trajectories in imaginary time. So if you consider your two-dimensional system, this is time from zero to beta, and this is space, you draw particle trajectories. Well, they're subject to the periodic boundary conditions in imaginary time. And there is a relation between the Wiening number. Wiening number is when some of the trajectory, of course, up to identity between particles, means that one of the trajectories makes a Wiening around the system. You can do it in different ways. It can be one trajectory, which is unlikely, because it's a big sample. The other way to introduce Wiening number, I'll just make it plot here. But this trajectory starts here, ends up here. This starts here, ends up here. This is also a Wiening number. But because particles are identical, I say, well, okay, it's one line can wind around. And if I go to zero temperature, the cylinder is as long as you want. And because it's as long as you want, one of the lines will start winding, or you just will start commuting particles places if your beta is not that long. But strictly speaking, if I talk about the ground state, I can put beta to infinity, and sooner or later, even one water line will go around the cylinder. So the superfluid density is defined as Wiening number squared. If I keep just beta and L the same, so I will say temperature at least goes to zero, the same way as say you scale, then I don't have to mention temperature separately from the system. So if it's just a cubic scaling of the system, then Wiening numbers are superfluid density is Wiening number squared divided by L.
Is it clear that recovers the conventional definition of the
Yeah, it's a conventional definition of superfluid density. This is just conventional definition of superfluid density as second derivative of the free energy with respect to the existing boundary condition.
But is it obvious that that relationship holds?
It's exact, yeah.
No, but I trust you that it's exact.
I can give the derivation. Okay. The derivation takes only one line.
Okay.
So you say that the partition function is the sum of Wiening number sectors, because only trajectories which wind around the system can cross the boundary. Only those trajectories are sensitive to the twisting boundary condition. So the partition function is IMP, and this is the partition function in a given Wiening number sector. And the dependence on the twisted boundary condition is explicit here. It cannot appear anywhere else. That's the only way. It's counting the number of trajectories which have crossed the boundary of the system. Just imagine you have a face on the Hopping matrix element on a certain cut. And whenever a particle crosses this cut, you get a face. That's all. Right now, you just write down that F is minus C log Z. You take the second derivative, and you have M squared.
Thank you.
From this relation, I just see the following. If there is no structure in the water lines, so if you go along the imaginary time, then water lines are like spaghetti. There is nothing telling the water lines what the particular structure, because they don't break any translational symmetry, which means that when particles keep changing places and move along the lattice, if there is no structure in water lines, sooner or later you introduce the Wiening number. If you introduce the Wiening number, the state is superfluid. So if there is no structure in the particle water lines as they develop in imaginary time. So it's more or less a chaos in those spaghetti. This state is superfluid. Because, well, there is nothing to stop you now that one of the trajectories, nobody watching it, if it's a chaotic distribution of water lines, nobody watching a particular water line, which can now go around the cylinder and make the Wiening number. Well, the other possibility is that, well, all water lines are structured, which means the water lines, when I go in imaginary time, the water line is just fluctuating around some fixed point. There is another point, and it's fluctuating like this. And this site is mostly empty. Of course, well, up to 0 point fluctuations, of course, your water line goes back and forth. But if there is a structure in water lines, if the water line leaves the lattice point, the surrounding water lines know, well, this space is empty, and maybe somebody will occupy it. So basically, the water lines will start behaving like this, but whenever one water line goes from one point to another, another water line is compensating. So the system has to know that this has to happen for sure. So if, well, you can write down, of course, models, for example, when bosons, in the ring exchange model, if bosons hop always like this, this model definitely is from, also you say, well, there's probably no structure in the water lines, But this model here doesn't allow any macroscopic current because you just conserve the number of particles on each row and on each column. And obviously it's from this kind of models. Whenever the water line, one particle wants to move one direction, the other will definitely compensate by the construction of the connector. So there has to be just, well, so I exclude this model kind of. It's possible that such a model can be written, but I'm just seeing, well, two possibilities. To avoid winding numbers, there has to be a structure in water lines which tells that one water line tries to move away the surrounding water lines, understand that they have to compensate for the particle going away from this one.
But models like that with these ring exchanges can be constructed which have zero superfluid density and have a gap.
Yeah.
So that one can then put in a perturbation back, which is
the I'll tell you just to say what is one excuse which I see from this picture. One excuse can be that water lines are marginally structured, which means you try to introduce winding number, but the winding number is not introduced, it's kind of, it's possible to have it, but only as 1 over L maybe to some power larger than 1. Which means in a thermodynamic limit, you have to say the superfluid density goes to 0. It looks like if it's kind of power law correlations between the water lines, if you have some algebraic order between the water lines, it will also work, because commonly we'll say that on large scale, you don't have any crystalline structure and the translational symmetry is not broken. At the same time, this algebraic order does tell the rest of the system that somebody wants to make a winding number, and the rest of the system compensates. That's just the only outcome I see. If it's generic chaos of water lines, you have winding numbers. Or your water lines have to be structured in some way. Well, that's my argument.
And well, there are counterexamples to your argument. And they're, as I say, models with large ring exchange terms so that when to sort of guarantee that when you have counterclockwise propagating water lines, you have clockwise propagating water lines, you cancel them. And particular models like that are constructed which have a gap to all excitations, that is, they're incompressible, they're insulators, they're not insulated with no broken translational symmetry, and they're stable to putting back in a small perturbation, which is, you know, the stable hopping strength.
Okay, and you say they do not break any of the translational symmetry.
Yeah, they don't.
Okay.
I mean, it may not be central to what your discussion, but I think it is.
No, it's not central to my discussion. I'm just saying, well, yes, that's how I would start denying Ginzburg-Landau, because I would say, well, I understand that maybe, well, there are some special models, and you say just this argument doesn't go through because, well, somewhere here, just maybe I'm not precise. I'm not saying it's a precise thing. I just, well, it's my expectation what I have by looking at the structural water lines.
So I've missed your argument. Are you saying that you've done the Ginzburg in your head, and you're now showing why you shouldn't have done so, or are you about...
No, I'm trying to argue that when I do this Ginzburg-Landau,
yes,
I have to put a hardcore constraint that one of the orders has to be present.
Yes. That's the argument, right?
That, yeah, that's the argument.
At least one has to be non-zero.
Yeah, at least one has to be non-zero. Because I want to avoid the state, which kind of seems to me unlikely, but well, I agree, well, if you say there are such models, I agree. I don't know what I'm missing just in terms of the structural water lines, because probably just all this argument is a little bit not nicely formulated that you can construct a model when the water lines are still structured in some way. Because somebody, it's definitely not a chaos of water lines. Particle trajectories are not just going at random, but that's for sure. Something keeps the structure of the state.
There can be subtle orders in that.
Yeah, maybe I'm missing some extra subtle order, which is not just, well, the simple translational symmetry breaking, which I'm trying to present. So probably there is some extra ordering.
And it's not any simple translational symmetry, it's more topological ordering, structure of the world lines.
Yeah, but there has to be some structure in the world lines. If you say there is some hidden topological order, well, I didn't mention it among the microparameters, and maybe you say, okay.
No, but it's not a local order.
Yeah, I understand it. I understand it, so just, and that's why I'm saying, well, the argument is not rigorous. I'm just trying to say that, well, this would be a naive approach from my point of view to the model. And if I do this, I more or less always come to the conclusion that transitions are always first order, or you have to have some phase which is a coexistence. I'll just try to illustrate how this works, for example, for the superfluid checkerboard case. So if I take superfluid checkerboard transition, and if I consider bosons with nearest neighbor coupling, it's identical to the Heisenberg antiferromagnet. In the Heisenberg antiferromagnet, this transition goes through the Heisenberg point. So if I take its nearest neighbor coupling, so it will be nearest neighbor coupling, and I try to go from superfluid to checkerboard, I have to go through the Heisenberg point. And the Heisenberg point, it looks like first order, in a sense that, well, the ground state of the Heisenberg model in two dimensions at zero temperature to broken symmetry. I simply have at this Heisenberg point, my order parameter, which I now constrain to first three components, is just pointing at some direction. If you want to move to the superfluid side, you just introduce easy planar anisotropy, and this vector is in the equator of this sphere, so this will be a superfluid. Well, if you introduce easy axis anisotropy, this already broken symmetry just becomes oriented vertically. This is the checkerboard solid. So for the nearest neighbor coupling, you go to this isotropic point. So exactly at the Heisenberg point, the energy landscape for the vector S as a function of theta is just flat. Now if I add next nearest neighbor coupling, or next nearest neighbor coupling, which will break SU2 symmetry of the transition point, we will simply modulate the straight line. And there are several ways you can just do it. One possibility is that, well, you make a potential barrier in between the two. In this case, you have first order transition, because, well, basically, I have to flip now the spin from equator to the pole, but, well, I have a potential energy barrier between the two. So generically, this line, if it's modified this way, it will become first order. Or you can envision that, well, probably the modification goes like this. So first, you develop a super solid, which means my vector will be pointing at some angle to the z-axis. So I have all three components non-zero. So it's a superfluid checkerboard, which is also allowed in general, if I do it. So the phase diagram in this case, if I do just the superfluid checkerboard transition, would be like first order line to second order line. This is super solid, superfluid, and this is checkerboard. And this is Heisenberg point. That's naively what I expect if I just, well, do this kind of theory. There is one kind of possibility which I am not excluding just, well, by saying it's a hard pole constraint. It's possible maybe that the effective temperature in front of this big S is such that, well, you can tune S to go to zero at some critical point. But what this one does, maybe, well, you can just make this modulus S go to zero by fine-tuning the parameters. But this will definitely require fine-tuning. So this scenario cannot explain a generic continuous transition. Maybe if I make it zero, I can have a continuous transition, but this will be definitely fine-tuning. So in this sense, just say, well, this Ginzburg-Landau scenario definitely tells you that typically you expect first order, maybe in special points of zero measure, you may have a continuous transition, but definitely not generic. Now I'll try to describe what the confined critical point scenario is for the superfluid valence bond solid transition. So how you can construct another scenario completely different from this one when the transition may happen as a continuous one. So it will be superfluid valence bond solid transition. The first consideration is, if you want to make a continuous transition for the solid, you have to ask yourself, okay, how this solid state will kind of be destroyed as you approach the critical point from the insulating side. When we discuss Ising systems, we say, okay, well, you create domains of the opposite orientation. And those domains grow with reticle structures. That's how you approach the critical point. Something has to be said about this system as well. You have to develop, if you want a continuous transition, you have to develop a scenario. What are defects which can drive this solid to be as close as you want to the continuous transition? So So I understand, well, this was basically the starting point of this discussion, and it says the following. Imagine that you can introduce a complex order parameter dx plus I dy. I'll describe this all shortly, just how it will work. So it has some modulus, and it has a phase. So you can describe the valence bond solid in the following way. Imagine that this complex order parameter described on very short scales the valence bond liquid. So on short scales, it's valence bond liquid, and its effective action will be cosine theta dI minus theta dj. But I know that on large scales, I still have to reproduce the solid which has four co-degenerate symmetry, so there has to be a term which fixes the direction of this vector. It has to be along x or y or minus x or minus. So I have also this term. Ultimately, it results that my state is a solid. But it's known that if I try to disorder this system and I bring the first term, forget about the second, if I bring the first term as low as I want to the xy transition point, the second term gets less and less relevant. So the idea is that the defects which you have in the valence bond solid are the main walls. So if I put here empty site, which is not part of any of the bonds occupied by the bosons, and you simply start drawing the structure of other bonds. Of course, well, this is a simple picture which I can draw only when the Z4 symmetry is strong abroad. It's a strong Z4 already. So in the solid, I can speak about bosons sitting on a particular bond. It's very easy to draw the picture. Once you get to the liquid, it's already a superposition of resonating diamonds, and so it's difficult for me to draw the picture. So that's how you come to this picture. So you have four phases. This is x, say y, minus x, minus y. And this defect is sitting at the intersection of two domain walls. But in terms of this order parameter, you see that, well, this order parameter is rotating around the center of this plane. So the idea is you start from the good solid, you start introducing those defects. And the more defects you have, you drive the valence bond solid to the valence bond liquid state because it's already strongly disordered. So once you approach the transition point, this last term, which drives you to the solid, becomes less and less relevant. So if you go to the transition point, just forget it. So make it zero close to the transition point. Well, strictly speaking, you may have it zero only at the critical point. So, and that's how you just say, well, I will ignore that the state is actually solid. Ultimately, the phase is solid. But in terms of the discussion of criticality, you can consider valence bond liquid as being a correct description of the phase on sufficiently short scales. So basically, this intersection of four domain walls become the vortex. And this vortex in the VBS liquid. And you have two types of vortices, because, well, this side can be empty, no boson here, or it can be occupied by one boson. So the charge of the state is plus minus 1/2 because we count from the background the occupation numbers 1/2. So it's one less or one extra from the background of 1/2. So those are, well, we can call them spinons because they carry charge plus minus 1/2. And they are vortices in the VBS liquid state. So basically the description of the continuous transition says you start from the solid, but then you understand that the solid is important only on a huge scale, so forget about those scales. And locally, your state looks like a VBS liquid with U1 symmetry, which is almost broken. And because it's broken, sooner or later, the cosine for theta will become relevant, and you will pick up one of the directions. But in all other respects, you can locally describe the cis state as if you have those vortices in the liquid.
If this is a stable state, solid, why doesn't the structure evolve back to one of the parallel sets?
No, of course it does.
A long distance away from that defect.
No, this is a defect. Of course you might have two defects. This is x minus x, y minus y. And so those defects, I can draw them. You say, well, it costs you energy. I said, yes, of course it costs me energy. But I'm discussing space-time evolution, so this is time. this is my space in the system. So you create this pair of defects, they live in time and disappear. So they kind of create spin on anti-spin on fluctuation, which can deviate a little bit. If it costs the energy, it will be a short loop and then it will disappear. Basically, I'm just trying to describe how my perfect VBS vacuum, written like here, can fluctuate. It can fluctuate by creating those two defects, which can separate for a while and disappear.
How much energy?
Maybe a lot. But as you approach the critical point, they become softer and softer. And ultimately, they will deconfine at the critical point. So at the critical point, those spin on anti-spin on pairs of vortices in the VBS liquid, they will proliferate and become macroscopically large. That's the scenario of how you can destroy the VBS solid in a continuous session. It's basically the same as you destroy conventional superfluid by proliferation of water flow.
But still, if you're in solid phase but too close to the critical point,
forget about all these. Ultimately, they are confined because this is a linear potential if it's in a true solid.
It's linear potential.
Yeah.
Linear.
If the cosine 4 theta term is relevant on this scale, so cosine is already working, it will become a linear confinement. But if this cosine term is relevant only on this scale, it's only logarithmic confinement. And the point is that, well, the more close you are to the critical point of the XY model, the less relevant is this term. So at the critical point, you can forget it.
At small distances, it is low, and then it's linear.
Yeah.
That's what
you're saying. Yeah. But it becomes linear on a much bigger length scale than the correlation length of the XY model. So it's irrelevant at criticality, that's right. So that's the continuous transition, which may happen maybe in this system in a continuous fashion. At least, well, that's the, if I'm right, you might be able to correct me, that's the confined critical point scenario. So you have a superfluid, which is U1 liquid, VBS liquid, which has two types of vortices, and the proliferation of those vortex loops, which are spin-ons, is the driving fluctuation taking you to the continuous point. That's the generic scenario, how this may happen in a continuous fashion. So I'm more or less done with different scenarios. Now I'll just discuss what we did in terms of numerical simulations and what we see. So I would say in all cases we see a picture consistent with this one. Maybe we're lucky, maybe we're not lucky, but in all cases which we studied so far, we have seen the first part. And I'll try to describe just why in terms of pictures, at least, you expect that this scenario, the spin-ons, is maybe difficult to realize in realistic quantum models. So what we did in terms of numerical simulations, just to verify which of the scenarios actually is working. Again, well, any simulation is not answering the question that something is not possible in principle. We just say, well, we didn't find the interesting physics, we found the boring one, which you more or less expect. There were two kind of simulations. One was done by Roger, Slatina, and Andrew Sendik. It's a ring exchange model. So the Hamiltonian for the ring exchange model is you have conventional popping of bosons between these named sites. And then you also have a term which takes two bosons on a plaquette. So I have a boson in this corner and I have a boson in this corner and converts those two bosons to go to different sides of the corners. They're all the plaquette, so it's simply all those two bosons go from those corners to those corners. That's the term which happens in the simulation. Of course, you can go back. So it's a ring exchange model. Well, it's called ring exchange. Well, I'm writing it in terms of bosons, but if you write it down in terms of spin operators, you basically say that you have four spins on the plaquette and you have just a ring exchange between them. Two of them have to flip down and two of them have to flip up. We did a little bit different model. If you take a quantum system of bosons on a lattice, you can draw particle trajectories. They are kind of continuous lines in time with some jumps between lattice points. But if you are looking for the continuous transition, you can discretize time because it doesn't matter on large scale whether your line is actually continuous in time or your imaginary time is discrete. So it's a well-known approach. So basically we take time discretization in water lines. So now our word lines can be written like this, because my imaginary time is now discrete, so they are just currents. For each point I on a lattice, it's space-time point, you have three dimensions, directions, direction x, direction y, direction tau. And here I have integer current leaving on the bond. It has to be integer because, well, the origin of this is that it's occupation number when you go in 10 directions with this particle occupation number, you count it 1, 2, 3, and when particle hops, it's just a hopping event, 1, 2, 3. They are subject to the zero divergence constraint because, well, the initial model was particle trajectories in imaginary time. Of course, when you see the particle trajectory going backwards in time, it's nothing but a hole because I'm counting from some background. So I will just, well, that's one possibility. Of course, well, if you take the chemical potential, this will be for the commensurate case. You have only closed loops of this kind. If you have chemical potential tuned in such a way that your bosonic occupation number is 1/2, then of course you have also water lines of this type from 0 to beta. Again, subject to periodic boundary conditions, so they are also loops because this is just extra particle going from 0 to beta. But with periodic boundary conditions, the configuration space of the model is integer zero divergent current. Zero divergence means, well, the number of lines entering the site is the number of lines exiting the site. That's all. Which means the configuration space is continuous loops. So our model was sum or all sites in tau direction was. Yeah, here we have price for the kinetic energy. Let me write it down. I don't know whether I have to specify the model, but it's from our lattice points. That's just to control that I have some energy for putting the line. Then I have to make sure that I have the right structure, that I have chemical potential exactly 1/2, and it's always half feeling like that. So we couple nearest neighbor bonds, this is x or y, you take a current which goes in 10 direction, minus 1/2, you take a current which goes in 10 direction but shifted by mu, tau minus 1/2 squared. Oh, sorry, that's it. This is nothing, this term, I'll call it J. It tries to make a checkerboard. What it tries to say, well, I try to arrange particles in such a way that I would like to prefer the checkerboard. And the model is made specifically, probably I have to put here also, J minus 1/2 for it squared. I try to make this model specifically particle hole symmetric. When any deviation from 1/2 to 1 or any deviation from 1/2 to 0 has exactly the same energy. So I always stay, on average, the number of particles is 1/2. And we also introduce coupling, which basically does the following. If I have some current on this space bond, it couples to the current on the neighboring space bond. So if this is 10 direction, so any spatial current on the bond couples to the spatial current on the neighboring bond. It simply tries to force the system to have the valence bond solid as a good phase. So if I make this term very large, I will force the boson. It doesn't matter in which direction this current goes, it's a couple modulus modulus. It forces the boson just to keep jumping on the same bond. And you also like that your neighbor in this direction also does the same. This term is introduced for the sake of having the valence bond solid in the phase diagram. But then we just have a model which is discretized imaginary time quantum mechanics, which has superfluid, checkerboard, and valence bond solid in the phase diagram. And again, just, well, if the transition is continuous, it probably doesn't matter how you write down the Microsoft model.
And it's now a three-dimensional model.
It's three-dimensional, yes. Well, this is XYL. So it's a three-dimensional tool. I would probably not bother you with pictures. What are particular results of superfluid density dependence on the parameters? We always see first order, but first order is very weak. We always see weak first order. So we need system sizes more than 32 cube, and only then we see third order. If you simulate smaller system sizes, the transition will look continuous. If you, for example, plot order parameters for a superfluid and checkerboard on system size 16, you'll see something like this. And they change place. The strange fact is that if you simulate now system with system size 16, if you simulate system size 64, the strange fact is that while plotting the transition point, system size 64 has a larger superfluid density. And this is already against the continuous scenario, how superfluidity disappears in continuous transitions, because you allow more space for phase fluctuations to destroy the condensate and superfluid density, but instead, in a bigger system, you have a bigger superfluid response. In this picture, when you fluctuate on the sphere, this is understandable. Your modulus S is not a critical mode anymore. And what happens in close to the Heisenberg point, if this potential is shallow, suppose I break the anisotropy in the Heisenberg point a little bit, the critical point fluctuations around this minimum are anomalous, which means the modulus of the order parameter is already fixed, but while it can rotate widely. So when you average on a small system size, there is no rigidity because this potential scales with the volume, with the system volume, the size of the potential energy barrier. But if it's the amplitude of this potential is weak in small system, in small system you can actually average the order parameter pretty well. But in a large system it will start freezing and eventually it will freeze. It's not phase fluctuation. It's simply rotation of some joint order parameter from superfluidity to checkerboard. And you can verify this numerically, this is exactly what happens. You just watch a joint CP6 of superfluid order parameter and the checkerboard order parameter, and you just see how the system converts one to another. And superfluidity disappears or gets smaller, because from configuration to configuration, you can analyze what your system is doing. When superfluid response is small, the system actually has checkerboard order. You keep the simulation going, checkerboard order disappears, superfluidity appears. The system is simply fluctuating on some three-dimensional sphere, and you can verify it in action. And ultimately, just well, if you study big system sizes, you see double peak distribution in the system CP6, which means system wants with some probability to be superfluid, with some probability it wants to be solid, and the probability density between the two states slowly vanishes. So if you go to system size 100, you already start seeing hysteresis and errors. But it's extremely weak for sort of condition. Now, in the simulations of the ring exchange model, I describe what we have here. I would say the finite size scaling is also strange because it shows that superfluid density is bigger in a bigger system size. So that's kind of the only conclusive evidence I see just in the data. Apart from bad finite size scaling and the attempt to describe the transition as continuous, you also see the same kind of feature. Superfluid density is bigger in the bigger system size. Probably this is not yet convincing to understand, okay, well, what's the transition in this model? Whether it's extremely weak first order, so maybe it's 128 cube, that's when you start seeing the first order. Unfortunately, to simulate the bigger system size takes an enormous effort. But we found another way how you can address the problem of spin-ons independently from what you see as a first order transition.
Wait, just a question. Did you also look at the case with going to the...
I forgot to say, yeah. When we do superfluid checkerboard transition, which is a picture consistent with this here,
mm-hmm.
When we do superfluid, forget about this one, it's zero. When we do superfluid valence bond solid transition, it's exactly the same picture. It's exactly the same picture. You see that superfluid density is big in a bigger system size. When you study joint fluctuations, now it's a four-dimensional space, it's not easy for me to recall. You see that when the system develops order in x direction, superfluidity disappears. When the order in xy disappears, superfluidity appears. And actually, see when superfluidity disappears, x and y can be converted to each other. So the system definitely is fluctuating along some four-dimensional sphere. And ultimately, it freezes in one of the directions. And we see the first order transition. So I would say it was consistent with the picture which I was trying to describe. Now we decided to...
Even if it is first order, do you see some topological fluctuations?
Yeah, I'll just try to decide it. Okay, first of all, is probably, okay, we are not lucky. We have been trying to get the transition, and we simply constructed a model which is first order. So it doesn't prove much. But at least we can say the following. This was our motivation. But if you see that on small system sizes, say in the case of ring exchange model, system size 64 is averaging okay, and you see something reminding you as if it's a continuous transition. So this is rho s, this is say valence bond order grant, and system size 64. It looks a continuous wave transition. What's the ultimate kind of fortune of this point? Maybe first order. But you can say at least the system on approach to the critical point behaves as if it wants to make continuous transition. So you may wonder that maybe on small scales, the picture of the valence bond liquid is already operational. You already have spin-ons on small scales. Well, they're still confined. And before they become deconfined, well, something unfortunate happens. You go first order. But still, on approach to the point, you did have spin-ons and this physics being present in the system. You simply cannot see it on a microscopic scale in terms of a true thermodynamic transition, but you have been closer. So how you can verify that somewhere here you do have spin-ons in the system? And there is a very simple technique. You just ask, and you immediately have an answer. I have spin-ons, but I don't. So that's how you do it. I go back to the Wining number. The Wining number simply counts how many trajectories in imaginary time have made a full turn around the system. But you can always construct a Wining number. The true Wining number is when you sum all the currents, you go all the sides, say Wining number in the direction mu, you go along all sides, you calculate all currents in the direction mu. This is side over all points in x y plane, sum over tau, and then you divide this by 1 over L. This is Wining number. Oh, sorry, I call it M. This is Wining number. It has to be integer. But you can always calculate this as a cumulated sum. So you can introduce M, sorry, it's M mu, and you introduce M mu tau, when you sum over tau prime, which is say less than beta and larger than zero. So you just keep tau as the parameter up to which you take your sum. Eventually, when you go to tau equals beta, you have to introduce to have integer. It has to be 0, 1, or 2, right? Or minus 1, minus 2. But now it's kind of a running sum. And here I have the same. Basically, well, this expression as a function of time is trying to tell me how the system wants to develop the Wining number as you go in imaginary time. So the typical picture would look, in the insulating phase, I know that Wining numbers are exponentially suppressed because superfluid density here in the insulating phase is exponentially small. It's a function of system size. But just like any instanton, you simply have to wait. You just keep running the code, or you make imaginary time long, you wait, and wait, and suddenly the system says, I have Wining number. You say, okay, tell me how it has happened. So I just plot here m mu tau as a function of tau. This is beta. So when the Wining number 1, say, happens, you try to see what it's doing. I'll show you one plot for 1D. If you do the same physics for 1D, you have a superfluid, it's probably better to call the transition from superfluid to valence bond kind of state in 1D, because it's kind of Haldane phase on the other side when you just make it easy access anisotropy. You go through the Heisenberg point in 1D, and you know that, well, in this case at least, we are absolutely sure spin-ons are there. They are the relevant degrees of freedom. And you see immediately that if you do this kind of analysis in 1D dimensional insulator, and you catch the system with Wining number, you see that the Wining number, you have all this sub-noise, is developed like this. And that's because, well, if you have kind of dimerized state in 1D, the way how you develop a Wining number, you just introduce a spin-on. Spin-on runs around the system, recombines with another partner, but the vacuum is shifted by one lattice spacing. So you cannot satisfy boundary conditions yet. You have to run the spin-on second time, you need a second instanton, and then the vacuum is restored. And because we are doing statistics, You always have to satisfy boundary conditions. So going from winding number 0 to winding number 1 happens always in two steps. So here you have one spinner running around the system, but it gives you only winding number 1 half. And you clearly see a flat hole at 1 half. Well, this is just another vacuum, so the system can stay here as long as you want. And then another instant pump happens, and the system has your winding number 1. It happens very rarely, but if you catch how it happened, you clearly see two instant cones and the platter at 1 half. So if you have spinners, you should see this again.
In a 1D case, because of spins, you create a spin on 1D. You can only create the repairs in practice.
I'm not telling you about the real spin-on. I say, well, it's a fluctuation how vacuum, because this is my initial vacuum. When you just break this part, and this spin-on runs around and recombines at this point, you produce this vacuum. It's a vacuum shifted, so it's not identical to this one. But if you try to understand what the response to the gauge field, it's one half of the true particle. If one particle goes around, you have winding number 1. In this case, you can easily just verify it in drawing pictures with water lines that you will get winding number 1 half. Because one particle is moving one space, and the position of the spinner is shifting by two letters spacing. And you see this signal clearly just well. If spinners are relevant, you will see them immediately in this signal.
What about the conservation of number of particles?
Same, well, it's the same number of particles here. I'm just simply saying you that, well, my vacuum is shifted by one letter spacing. But, well, the true period now is actually two letter spacing, it's not one. So it's not the same vacuum. You need another fluctuation. Now you will restore the same vacuum.
Why don't you calculate Urinal Wilson loop, so you put two static impurities and see how energy depends on distance between
them? I don't know what's easier. Maybe, well, this will require the analysis of energies. I just don't do nothing. You just run the standard code. You say, well, winding number has happened. You just analyze the configuration. It will tell you immediately that winding number has happened in two steps.
So, but generically, it's equivalent to Wilson loop.
It should be. Well, you'll have to separate maybe different contributions, but I would say yes, probably. If you do the right calculation, you should see the same physics. I say, well, it's a very simple technique. It doesn't require anything, just like to program it. But the signal is clear. So when we do this analysis for our model in the insulating state, on system sizes, say, 8, when we are not seeing trap transition yet, and Anders did exactly the same analysis for the learning exchange model, for system sizes, as far as I remember, 32 cubed. And we studied instant tones in this model, sitting in the insulator and just waiting for the winding number to happen. In all cases, we just see only those instant tones. We never see one half. So winding number, whenever it is introduced in the system in the insulating phase, always happens in multiples of integers. So probably just all this picture of getting pretty close, it looks like a continuous line, but we don't see spinners at the microscopic level. So we try to just to see them, but unfortunately, this technique always gives us integers. And I probably try to just to draw a picture again. Why kind of this is a natural thing? The scenario itself, I like it very much because that's probably the interesting scenario. Apart from having this a little bit standard physics. But why we don't see spinons, which are kind of vortices in the VBS liquid? And we had a discussion with Leon Barnes why child labor is so pink. And he says, just look at the physiology of it. And so, our argument is probably that, the physiology of the spinon you can just view the physiology of the spinon as follows. That's kind of our understanding of what's happening. If I have a spinner as a vortex in the VBS liquid, there is nothing protecting the charge, just what to say, the vortex core has to be charge 1 half. So suppose I start from this picture. The following kind of quantum fluctuation will easily happen in this case. This will become empty side. We have two particles. It's one particle. This is a particle. Well, remember, I'm counting from the certain occupation number. So subtracting the vacuum, this is charge 1. What happens next is that, well, you still keep the vortex core, you restore the structural bond around, and this particle goes a little bit away. Of course, creating an extra particle in this picture takes energy, because particles are gapped. So this particle will, of course, eventually come back. It's simply another point of view. You can say that particle is a composite of two spin-ons, and I'll take another point of view, which is identical in terms of kind of general discussion, but it's different in terms of how I view the system microscopically. So I'll say, well, this picture suggests me the following, that I have to look at the spin-on at the vortex core. The size of the vortex core is a small part, then I have a rotating VBS liquid. And then I have a particle which is delocalized around the vortex core, and this is particle. The total charge of this whole construction is plus 1/2. But I have to view it rather as a charge of the vortex core, which is minus 1/2, and particle plus 1, which is localized on the vortex core. It's like a hydrogen atom. So the spin-on itself is a vortex core, and it has a particle wandering around, because, well, the particle is gapped, so it's definitely a bound state. But that's rather the microscopic picture of what I have for the spin-on. Not just call the spin-on 1/2 and saying that the VBS liquid is rotating around. This is definitely right on big scale. But on a short scale, I would say, well, it's a vortex core and the particle which is localized around the negatively charged core, the hydrogen atom. And what happens first, apparently, in our system, is that as you approach the continuous point, maybe we do have spin-ons at very heavy and almost immobile vortex core. So that's what happens in this picture. And I have particles between all those vortex cores. And what happens first is the Mohr transition. So you introduce more and more defects. On each defect, you have a delocalized particle. And so the transition which happens first is not the deconfinement of spin-ons. But first particles zip through the system and you introduce integer winding numbers and the transition goes to the superfluid state. I don't know why it happens first order, but at least I see that even at the microscopic level, when I try to study winding numbers, particles are the first to give me winding numbers and to fill periodic boundary conditions. Maybe because spin-ons by construction are a little bit heavy and particles are much more mobile. And so the first channel which you have in the system for superfluidity to happen is not the confinement of spin-ons, but particles do it first. So you need more special kind of tuning of the model. So spin-ons are much more mobile, and particles are better localized on the spin-on core. So that's just, well, kind of my intuition and trying to explain why we see integer winding numbers, because particles are the element channel, which gives you a superfluid response. Just explaining the data a little. So that's all about the data. I would say just, well, it's not the happiest outcome, but, well, that's what we see. I unfortunately don't have time, because I wanted to discuss XY models in general, but that's different.
Well,
you
can go on
if
you
want. Yeah. I would say this is kind of the introduction to the story. Because the interesting part for us was just to understand the criticality of the deconfined critical action if it may happen in nature. Let's forget about realistic models. Let's assume that this scenario can be realized in nature. And you can have, you know, the vortices in VBS liquid, they do decouple. So the question is, what's the criticality of this? So I find this question a little bit more interesting than whether the realistic system can be easily constructed which has this physics. So far, we're not lucky to construct one. I'll try to just, well, to discuss what the conventional XY model does and why I find it kind of a little bit amusing.
To what extent are your simulations consistent with the earlier smaller size simulations done by Sandvik et al. And Scolatina?
On small system sizes, Sandvik and Scolatina see continuous transition.
Right. And what do you see on small?
Exactly the same.
Exactly the same.
Well, simply, well, there is a difference, say, by a factor of 4 between us. For example, they have system size 32 perfect continuous. So we don't suspect that order. Mm-hmm. The only suspicion comes that because the 64 line is above 32 line. And 128 line is above 64 line. superfluid density here increases as a function of the system size. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit strange for the standard continuous transition, because in the most naive scenario, you expect that superfluid density times system size is a universal constant at the critical point, which means superfluid density scales down with the system size as you approach the critical point. You allow more space to develop phase fluctuations, but in this case, it does the opposite. You stay close to the transition point, and you see that superfluid density increases as a function of system size. So that's the only kind of strange behavior, because to explain it, you have to say that, well, the dynamical critical exponent is negative, but that's kind of, that's already a violation of continuous phase transition. So that's the only strange thing about the data.
You're not really simulating exactly the same model as them, are you?
Well, we don't have to. They do the better job. They do ring exchange model, which is a completely different model.
Yeah.
It's not ring exchange model. But our data look identical up to just adjusting system sizes. We have same scenario, but because our model is more simple in terms of implementation. It's purely classical, you work with integers, you can easily simulate a big system size. Yes, we have first order system size 32, but we can go to 128 and see double peak structures, hysteresis, and all the rest. We can verify its first order without any doubt.
But can you explicitly map the discrete model, the ring exchange model, onto your model?
Explicitly, no, unless I take a special limit. If I take k going to be large, I will make sure, well, that's, we discretize imaginary time. But if I introduce a penalty for introducing any of the lines, I will be forced to continue, eventually jump, and continue again. And my lines will represent the continuous limit as close as I want. But probably if I want to do ring exchange model in my representation, I have to make L tau much, much bigger than Lx and Ly. Say by a factor of 20. And then I can be as low as I want to the amount. At the cost, of course, of just having a much bigger configuration space. We can do quantum Monte Carlo simulations of this model as well. We didn't do it because we say, well, if it's a continuous transition, why should we worry about microscopic details? We just do what's simple and flexible, because here we can engineer almost anything we want.
Nevertheless, can Anders directly have a look at his mnemonic in this model on spin-on configuration?
That's what he did. His model is quantum. And
doesn't see any spin-on.
No, I'm saying Anders did the analysis of instantons, and his instantons are integers. Yeah, well, he did this analysis. There is no clear signature that this model has a first order when you just see a clear plot, you have double peak distribution, how system fluctuates, say, in the solid order parameters, you see, well, it wants to stay zero solid, but it wants to stay finite solid, and almost nothing in between. So it's double peak distribution as you expect it in the first order transition. But maybe to see it, you have to get a much bigger system size, and typically to see the double peak distribution, if your system size is that big, it's extremely tedious job. You have to tune the parameters extremely well, maybe to fourth or fifth digit.
But still, these are two separate issues, whether it's second order, first order, or this is one point, another point, if there are these topological excitations.
Yes, they are, strictly speaking, they are different, yes. It seems we have first order, and second, well, we don't see spin-ons, even on a small size system. So even small-scale fluctuations happen as particles. But again, well, this simply proves that, well, we have two different models, maybe, and that's all. It doesn't prove you that this scenario is not possible in principle. So it's a separate issue, just, well, to discuss the criticality of this scenario in principle, if you can construct some model which can be actually taken to this. Well, I can see, okay. So the other observation which we recently made about XY model, I don't know, maybe it's trivial in some sense, we start looking at properties of XY models just in general, because, well, this particular model, we can find critical point. This is the model of, when you have two XY models, and you have cosine theta 1i minus theta 1j, this is describing spin-on of type 1. Then I also have spin on of type 2. And they are both coupled to the gauge field, IJ. And there is some parameter characterizing the strength of the gauge field. So this is the model of the deconfined critical action. You have some extra parameter J in some of the different sizes. Well, why this model? This model is simply because if you look at the statistics of vortices in VBS, they complode loops. They are quantum fluctuations you have created, vortex anti-vortex pair, they propagate in time and disappear. It's an oriented loop. And because I have two types of spinons, you have two types of oriented loops. And because they are vortices, not particles, they couple through the supercurrent in this liquid, which is conventional Biot-Savart law between the two vortices in conventional superfluid. And that's basically the whole derivation of this model. Because, as you know probably, in high-temperature series expansions, if I do classical physics, or if I just stay at the level of two-dimensional quantum model, this term represents fluctuations of vortex anti-vortex pairs. So this term gives you integer current, divergent to zero, integers, loops, oriented loops. This term gives you the same. And the last term, because you can integrate in this case the gauge field out exactly. So if you integrate the gauge field out exactly, here you have J currents 1, here you have J currents 2. They're exactly the same as I discussed previously. But they are also coupled together by long range forces. This is point R. There is some potential between them. And this potential comes from the conventional Biot-Savart law in superfluids. It's 1 over R minus R prime. So you basically just deconfined critical action is a particular type of XY model. So this is coupling between them, and in addition, of course, you have terms like J1 squared plus J2 squared with some coupling constant U in front. So this would be conventional XY, and then I have long-range coupling between two XY models. So that's why this, well, the whole scenario is in the class of multi-component XY models coupled by different forces. If I take this potential to be short-range, like lambda delta function R prime, this would be a standard theory of two coupled Psi-4 models. You have two XY models with short-range interaction between them. And the deconfined critical action is different from two coupled XY models by having this interaction long range. So the question is whether long range interactions are relevant for criticality or they are not relevant for criticality. And I would say, well, I don't know the answer to this question yet. We'll try to understand it. Why I'm saying that typically you would say, of course, long range interactions are important for critical phenomena. If you simply go from short range to long range, you expect a huge change in the critical behavior. And that's what we know. And then there is one fact about XY model, which puts this a little bit in doubt for me. Now I'll try to explain. It's the result which was derived more than 20 years ago, for example, by Gupta and Halpern, that if I take this XY model and write down conventional XY model, and you write down the action of this XY model, for example, in this, it's the simplest possible way you can write down some interacting action for closed integer currents. Now, if I make a transformation, which is called the duality transformation, it's exact. You can convert this, those J's are, again, zero divergence integers. This module converts to R, LR, LR prime. And again, those L's are integer zero divergent currents. And the mapping is understood that, well, here I'm talking about particle word lines. So particle word lines make fluctuations. For example, the XY model is describing, I'm jumping a little bit from the subject of solids because I changed entirely now to statistical mechanics a little bit. Take my model, you can view it as a transition between Mott insulator and superfluid. So those J's are fluctuations of particle numbers from the commensurate solid Mott insulating state. So those are particle hole fluctuations, here they form loops. When you make this duality transformation, you go to word lines of vortices. And that's kind of a dual representation, but it's exact. But what's strange about this kind of duality? If you start from short-range model, you end up with long-range model, because this is 1 over r minus r squared. It's same configuration space, but you have changed the potential from short-range to long-range. But you're describing exactly the same x-y transition. So the conclusion you might have is that, well, okay, the x-y transition, it's one transition from the left and completely different transition from the right. And sometimes people call, for example, if you work in this representation, you call the transition xy. If you work in this representation, you call the transition inverted xy. But at least the general perception is that, well, the correlation length is the same. So it doesn't matter from which side you approach the U1 transition. The correlation length is the same. And most of the critical exponents will remain the same. No matter that the statistical mechanics, when you try to calculate all averages, this model and this model have nothing in common, looks like, because, well, this is a long-range interaction. So I believe
what... Amplitude might be different. Amplitude would be different.
Amplitude can be different, of course, yeah. Yeah, this is allowed. But, so what I think we believe, that we can more or less prove rigorously, that if you do a renormalization group on this model, and to do the renormalization group in this case, it has a very nice advantage. You can easily introduce coarse grain variables, which are scale invariant. And that's very easy to argue. Because if you do, say, Ising model and you introduce average magnetization, you have an extra kind of difficulty that average magnetization has its own scaling dimension. In this case, we don't have this difficulty. We can easily introduce coarse grain renormalization group variables, which are scale invariant. And the argument is very simple. I have zero divergence integer currents. Now, if I take a cube of big size U, integrate all current loops, so all loops of size less than U over 2 have to be integrated out. They have no contribution to my answer. The remaining, the loops which are remaining, you just calculate for other loops. You introduce J, which is the sum of all J's on a facet. So if this is a facet and this is direction mu, you take a facet of the cube perpendicular to the direction mu, you sum all the currents from loops inside bigger than u divided by 2, you may have several of them. Then you sum all of them. It's R, belong to the facet, direction mu. This is your J mu. It's a coarse grain variable. Again, just because, well, the way how I construct this variable, it's zero divergent and integer. And moreover, this variable is constructed to mimic winding numbers in a system with periodic boundary conditions. If you imagine this cube and you close the edges, you will have winding number. And from Josephson relation, we know that winding numbers, I had it somewhere, that rho s, okay. Rho s was winding number squared divided by L, but Josephson relation says that rho s is 1 over L in a system size L at the critical point. So winding number fluctuations are 41. So I have a guarantee that at the critical point, J square average is 41 in this system size. So which means when I construct those four grain variables, they remain zero divergence integers of 40 units. So now I just will start constructing the renormalization group flow, how different interactions can scale in this model. And you can show, well, basically two facts. One is that if you have coupling between n currents far away from each other, then this coupling, to be a fixed point, has to scale as r to power n. Because when you just, well, I'll just probably skip the details, I can go through them. It means that only J squared over R squared is dominating in the sum, because, well, if I have pairwise currents, they give you J squared over R squared, but if you have four, the four order term is much smaller at large distances. So basically, it's our kind of, we can call it conjecture, and then I'll tell you just, well, what the proof we have that it's worth. So So our conjecture is that, well, if you do this RG, you will come to the effective action where the long-range part with some amplitude A, and plus you have short-range part, which is very complex, involves more than two GAs, and we have no idea what this is. So this is an effective action. And it's supposed to work when you have the scale of the cross graining, U is definitely much bigger than A, and much less than the correlation length, which we formally just say, well, is infinite, because we are at the critical point. So at the critical point, you can construct an action which works only for sufficiently large distances, but we believe that the long-range part of this action is exactly one. It's quadratic in currents, because, well, that's how it has to scale when I increase the size of the cube from out from large distance. You have to see that this current has to scale as a linear power. And we see that, well, all higher order couplings, to remain at the critical, at the fixed point, they have to be coupled by r to power m. So when you take more than two currents, it's definitely a weak interaction. But we have no control on the short range part. So now just, well, what we have in mind is, if you take an XY model, you have short range interactions and long range interactions. Both in this model and this model, they go to 1 over r square law between the currents with different amplitudes. So this goes 1 A1, 1 over r squared, and A2, 1 over r squared. So the XY model and inverted XY model, they're actually not that different at the critical point. You may start from microscopic interactions, completely different, short range and long range. But the short range is renormalized to 1 over r squared, and the long range is renormalized to 1 over r squared. The long range screening is kind of obvious. If you have a vortex, you calculate the energy of the vortex as an integral, ms dr over r. That's the standard calculation of kinetic energy of the rotating current around the vortex. And if I substitute here the Josephson relation, that on scale r, the superfluid density is screened, you get the law, which is 1 over r squared. It's simply screening of by small vortex loops. On large scale, vortices are coupled by 1 over r squared. And this follows from the Josephson screening. In a way, just, well, my statement here is simple, because this would imply that you have universal conductivity at the critical point, and if the two amplitudes are different, you'll have different universal conductivities for particles and for vortices. So at this point, I'm not saying, well, our result is contradicting anything which is already known and probably can be easily guessed. The only claim we're making is actually, well, those laws allow you to write down this action at intermediate scales. Now, what proof we have that this picture is actually working? There are two critical indices. Probably I'll just skip the definition of indices. There are two.
Are you saying that you can generate a long-range interaction between the currents? I mean,
yeah, you always generate it. Yeah, sure.
How is that? That's not possible, though. I mean, you can only generate short-range interactions.
No, that's wrong.
You start with a model with short-range.
No, that's wrong. I'll explain where it happens. If you start with long-range, it's more or less you can say, well, screen. You come to 1 over r squared. Second, if you say there is universal conductance from the particle side, this is almost an example. And I'll just show you just why you generate long-range couplings between in the short-range model. In the Mott insulator, if you look at the particle-particle interactions, it's easy for me just to speak in the channel when two currents go in the same direction. Density. When the gap in the Mott insulator is closing, you can exchange long wavelength form. Because the gap is so small, so if you get to a distance smaller than the correlation length, there is exchange by phonons between two densities. Two-dimensional hydrodynamics on a square lattice immediately tells you you have a potential 1 over r squared. It's unavoidable. It's just because the system grows gapless, when you start developing the Goldstone mode, conventional currents will start generating 1 over r squared. And you may say, well, where in the cross-graining I have introduced this long-range coupling? So it looks like in cross-graining you don't do it. But that's the specific of my variables which I'm using. Imagine that I have those cubes. So I did my cross-graining. I have this current and I have this current. But those loops I integrated out. And just compensating. Because you see, for a given J here, and given J here, you can take the rest of the loops out, or you put them in. And but those structures are completely integrated out by my precision. For the same Postgres J here and J here. For each plaquette, you always have one current going this direction, the other current is going opposite direction. So having no loops at all, or having them, it's exactly the same configuration space for coarse-grained winding number. So when you introduce those coarse-grained variables, part of the configuration space, which you integrated out, already contains loops of infinite size.
Are you describing a mathematical implementation?
No, I'm just trying to answer. No, I'm trying to answer the question how you can generate long-range interactions starting from the short range.
Well, but do you have a mathematical implementation of some real space normalization group? Because it's just a picture, which is fine. I mean, it's coming.
No, we are exactly specific what those variables are and how you construct them. And second, because of the way how we construct those variables is a straightforward prescription.
The integration is not.
The integration is not, just like always. You say, well, you integrated all other degrees of freedom except those. Yeah, I say, fine. It's difficult for me to integrate them out. But I can see, because they are scale invariant. The advantage which I have here in this construction of the normalization group is that I have scale invariant for grain variables. They do not scale when I increase the size of the cube. It's exactly the same, zero divergence, integer, or for the unit.
And you're able to conserve current.
Yeah, because I conserve current. And so the rest you have to study is just, well, okay, what's the nature of interactions between them at the fixed point? And the only, because I know how those variables are constructed, I can easily see that, well, any interaction which is not power m in front of m currents dies away. So the only fixed point Hamiltonian is consistent with this structure. And it's dominated by square-square at large distances. At short distances, I have no idea. Of course, you have everything at short distances that's completely out of my control and I can never do it. I can only make a claim about longer range interactions. When you stop your normalization at size u, and you look at the couplings on a much bigger distance, then we claim it's one of us. I can tell you just one kind of fact which we know for sure now. If you do XY model, there is a certain exponent I can introduce it. Well, this exponent is called Hausdorff dimension.
Gauss-Stoll logics give you this 1 over r squared, right?
Yes.
And this is two-dimensional situation. If I have three-dimensional situation, the same Gauss-Stoll logic gives me 1 over r cubed, right?
Probably. Just well, I don't want to jump to this something which I didn't think about. I don't want you to give a quick answer without thinking.
But Gauss-Stoll is straightforward.
I know what you're saying.
Can I expect that vortices are some skirmions in 3D?
I don't want to do this. Well, immediately this change in my mind to this statement. I don't want to lie, but I understand. I'm telling you. Maybe you can generalize it to four dimensions. I will refrain from answering the question. So there is only one kind of confirmation that this is working. For the XY model, there is a certain exponent which is called Hausdorff dimension. If you take a critical loop, say this distance is r, and you look at the length of the loop. So the distance between the two endpoints is r, and the length of the critical loop is l. There is a scaling law that r scaled is l to power c, d. This is called the Hausdorff dimension. For some mysterious reasons for me, this quantity is very easy to measure with very high accuracy. So we know the two numbers for the Hausdorff dimension for this model and for this model.
Okay, wait, how do you...
It's the other way around.
L is the output. Oh, yeah, sorry. Yeah. So we have two numbers. D for the model J is 1 over 1, 5, 6, 6. And the accuracy is 1. And D for model L is 1 over 0, 4, 1, 6. They are very well measured and very easy measured. Much better than you can measure, say, the relational length and so on. And they are different.
It's not related to eta in any way, is it? I'm sorry.
No, it's not. I believe it's not. It's a separate thing. So this is a separate just little argument. Many other people believe it is.
And it is what?
Related to eta. But it's not. Just because once you have error bar on the second digit, you are in doubt whether it's related to eta or not because eta is pretty small. Because the other statement which many people do in their papers is this is 2 minus eta. But because eta for the XY model is known as 0, 0, 3, 8, that's not us, how the people measure it. You see that this relation is strongly violated. So this is something like 1, 7, 6, I don't remember exactly. So it's definitely in violation of this by more than 26. So this is definitely not 2 minus f. So there is no question about this. No, it's a little bit aside from my discussion, but it's also interesting, but it's different. So because we know those two exponents, you can say, well, okay, I can present, and we already have this result, but I can present a model, suppose at the microscopic level, when I take this model, r minus r prime squared, jr, jr prime, plus short range, and this model can be taken from J representation to L representation. The advantage of those models, if I go to the Fourier representation for this potential, it looks like A divided by Q plus constant. Under the duality transformation, the long-range part of the potential in Fourier space is exactly the same. It's, I know, 1 over A, Q plus another constant. So at least, well, this model, under the duality transformation, goes from 1 over r squared plus short range to 1 over r squared plus short range. And we can just explicitly give you a model with a particular value of A, which under the duality transformation reproduces both indices. So it's a 1 over r squared model, which in J representation has this value. It's self-dual in the sense that, well, the law momentum part of this function here is this one, and it's exactly the same in the dual model. It's again 1 over r squared, and this model reproduces the dual index when you go to L representation. So it has both critical indices reproduced in a model which looks self-dual. Of course, the structure of the short-range terms is a little bit different, but they are short-range. So we believe that, well, that 1 over r squared is definitely the part of the physics at large distances. Is because we can find that, well, the model written in terms of 1 over r squared is capable of reproducing all the critical indices. If you change A, all critical indices are continuous functions of A. So D is a function of A. A continuous function.
What does all this mean? I mean, when you do this, are you assuming somehow that the vortex degrees of freedom are the relevant ones for the phase transition, and then somehow you're finding that there are other fluctuations that are important too in the short range?
I would say that, well, the exact duality, I erase it or what? No, this one. I would say that this exact mapping, which was done by Indesbuk and Hopper, says that vortices are the relevant degrees of freedom for the XY transition from the superfluid side. Because you can entirely discuss the XY transition in terms, because this is identical to the Psi-4 model. There is no question. This is definitely XY model and has exactly the same universal properties. We have already measured all those exponents for J currents, for true XY in the phase representation, for Psi 4 soft core model. It's exactly the same index. So definitely universal, doesn't matter how you write down this model. But this model meant for vortices coupled by Birsavar law. And it's exact. So I just say, yes, it's exact proof that vortices of fractional dimension are responsible for the destruction of superfluidity. Whether we like it or not, I know some people doing, I know, epsilon expansions to high order probably will disagree that, well, they like the vortex picture, but it's exactly it. Vortices are definitely there. Maybe you don't know the critical exponent for the vortex loops and how they behave, but that's a different question. Because this description says that, yes, proliferation of vortex loops is the driving force for the superfluid transition. But, well, somehow we believe that, well, doesn't matter, long or short range models, they all scale to the same behavior 1 over r squared. But the important point is what's the coefficient here. So international XY model, one component, we have two different numbers. This is the universality class, this number. For short-range models, this is the universality class for 1 over r models. But if you go and write down continuous 1 over r squared models, they have continuously changing critical indices. And this is already measured. There's no doubt in this. So basically, short-range and 1 over r are two m's of the 1 over r squared candidate. And I believe that same is true in multi-component system. You also scale to 1 over r squared, but now you have a matrix of couplings in front of 1 over r squared, and different universality classes are different couplings between in this law. But
how weird is it that these Hausdorff dimensions are not 2 minus a?
Can I just, if this actually is a, like, make sure we have some kind of structure to these things. Could you maybe summarize, and then we come to a question period?
To summarize, I would say I believe that XY models at the critical point are described by 1 over r squared law. The universality class of short-range models is simply different amplitude, or long-range models is different amplitude for this law. And multi-component systems behave the same way. They simply have A, which now depends on colors. A and B are colors. And that's how you can characterize universality classes of multi-component XY models. It doesn't matter whether you have short-range or long-range couplings, you simply flow to different amplitudes for this 1 over r squared law. And all indices will be continuous functions of them.
Can you think this in all dimensions?
I'm comfortable about 2, but I have to think. I cannot distinguish it.
Okay.
2 questions. 1. I mean, well, 3-dimensional. If you say classical XY, 3-dimensional. Or quantum at 0 temperature, 2-dimensional. What I'm saying last is not a proof, it's a speculation. We're having more proof about one component, and so far close to no proof in multi-component. So one of the predictions, which is at least at this point, is probably absolutely vague. But the confined critical point might be U1 plus U1 point. Maybe not. So we don't know this yet. For sure we don't know this. So I don't want to speculate because we didn't prove it up to the final end. Because basically our message is that the long-range interactions are not that important in XY models because of the screening.
Isn't everything known about the 3D XY?
For example, this relation is not known. Some people think still that, well, Hausdorff dimension is 2 minus epi. And I, as far as I can tell, nobody is saying that you can present 1 over r squared model, which is self-dual in terms of the structure of the interactions, which can reproduce both indices. I would say it's not known, at least it was not known for us. And if you read the literature, this is definitely what people think. They calculate d and they claim it's 2 minus epi, and that's how they measure epi. Because they don't have a good tool to measure epi as a correlation function, well, for some numerical reasons, so they prefer to measure d and spin it. But for the conventional XY, the accuracy is definitely out of scale just to say that this relation is working. It's definitely not working.
So you get that by simulating this one, this 1 over r squared model? Or
no, you can get this by simulating 1 over r squared model if you want. You can get it by simulating this model. That's the answer for this one. And that's the answer for this one. And there is 1 over r squared model which can reproduce this and this at the same time. One and the same one. Otherwise, this exponent is a continuous function of A. And we have measured several of them. They're just interpolating between the two.
Okay,
I am not speculating. Also, we have a pretty strong evidence. I don't know whether it's, so far it's just numerical. I don't understand how it works. That the amplitude A, for some reasons, is related to universal conductivity. Because, for example, when we found this self-dual model, because universal conductivity for the particle side is 0.33. And we found that A was 0.333. I don't know whether it's important or not. We don't know. I would say just the game of numbers, I'm not sure this is a correct relation. That the coefficient in front of power, R1 over R squared, is somehow related to universal conductivity. It may, because they may be.
It's a conductivity is a current-current correlation function. I mean, this is a current-current piece of the action. The only question is order of limits.
Yeah.
Do you want to make over 0? Other than that,
I'll write down the quadratic part, yes. S2 is j q squared 2 pi over q a divided by q. And this is an exponent. And the universal conductivity is the average of this, j q squared 2 pi over q. That's the universal conductivity. When you take the limit that q is much bigger than 1 over l, much smaller for this. And this
would be surprising if that were the same.
It is, because I know the fluctuations are not Gaussian. I measured the fluctuations of this quantity, it's not Gaussian. And because it's not Gaussian, I cannot say that A and sigma are related. And that's the trouble for me, because I see they are not related by naive argument as if it's a Gaussian. Because it's definitely not Gaussian, and if you measure this, it's not Gaussian.
It's Gaussian integral subject to constraints.
Then. Yeah, because you have zero divergence on integers, you cannot say it's a Gaussian integral.
So different. But you can take Gaussian integral, you, including the constraints exactly, there is no problem with that.
Well, if you can do it, fine, but I don't know how to do it. Maybe you, then you know how to relate this A to sigma. Then you can relate it to quantities. I don't know how to relate it.
It's an integer.
Yeah, as soon as your fields are continuous, real numbers, any Gaussian integral.
Which fields are continuous?
So as soon as your
J's are integers, zero divergence. They are zero divergence integers.
Can I ask a rude question? This is very beautiful, this is for mechanics. Could you give us, in your vision of how this kind of research can connect up to experiments on condensed matter? Say atom traps, or where would it fit in?
Experimentally, where you can find superfluid solid transitions. For example, in optical lenses. So that's the easiest. Because, well, in a way, we are discussing clean models.
But I think your original conclusions were that it should be a first order transition.
What
so would you now, if you met an experimentalist, say that they should be looking for first order transitions?
If you ask me what I believe in terms of. If you just measure some system, what are chances you will see a third order instead of second, I would say 99%. Because I didn't tell you just, well, we simulated to a great extent one particular model. It was weak third order. But then we made 15 different models trying to modify the interactions, make it longer range. We tried hard just to make VBF solid to become liquid. In all cases, we have maybe 15 different cases, it's always third order. Sometimes extremely strong third order. We never found anything else. That's just our frustration. We cannot find or engineer the model which is different from first order. So if you ask experimentally, I would predict first order.
But what do they see in the optical lattices?
Nothing so far.
Yeah, nothing.
Yeah. Nothing so far. But I'm saying just, well, my expectation is because, well, of our experience, first order will be the most likely outcome in the experiment.
So the subsequent research into deconfined criticality is because you find it a stimulating intellectual pursuit?
Yes, because well, the model of several complex early parameter fields coupled to the same gate. It's not only from condensed matter.
So
most of the papers are from particle physics.
Okay. So but you're not willing to speculate where this physics might come alive in the domain of experiment.
Yeah.
Well, you need a superfluid with at least two types. Well, of course, here. Oh, yeah, sorry. The easy part here is one component XY model. One component XY model is saying that the transition from neutral superfluid or charged superfluid are different. There are different things which you can, if you can measure them, they are different. So neutral and charged superfluids behave differently. For example, the distribution of vortex loops is different in a charged superconductor than in neutral helium 4. And probably you can measure those exponents, but unfortunately for this you need a superconductor which is high TC superconductor, because you need a broad fluctuation region to do the study, but then it becomes dirty or disordered and it's probably very difficult to do the study. I know how easy it is, because I know there were some measurements and they are conflicting with each other for high temperature superconductors, how superfluid density is scaled to zero. So it's a related question, I guess, well. Because whenever you introduce a gauge, you basically go to a dual model. 1 over R would be charged superconductor has vortices which are not coupled by long range because it's simply the supercurrent is completely swinging. You have London penetration there. So then how charged superconductor goes normal. It's exactly the same as particles go superfluid. So this is related to this question, but unfortunately experimental studies are very difficult on this.
Okay, any more questions? Thanks very much, Nicole.